When I landed, it was quite a surprise to me to find that all these people were there waiting. I hadn't anticipated that at all. And I was just looking forward to seeing Sally and my folks. And I didn't even know if they would be there, as a matter of fact. But this caught me completely off guard, and I didn't anticipate the public reaction. But I did the best I could to respond to it, and so I really ran for about 8 months after I came back, just running and running and running with lectures and boat shows and appearances and so on. And then finally I just had to slow down a little bit. My stomach was starting to bother me, and I'd been gone so much from home. So I decided to slow up a little bit and start thinking about what I wanted to do rather than just responding to what other people wanted me to do. So actually that summer of 1980, or last summer, I decided then that what I want to do was do some more sailing in the boat. And so I started making plans for that, and did an enormous amount of work on the boat during the fall, along with other obligations, still with lectures and so on, and the book and these things. But I re-fiberglassed the boat, and repainted the inside, took everything out and repainted her, and got her ready for another voyage. Basically, the boats remain the same, but I've freshened her up, and she wasn't really damaged going across the Atlantic, but being transported around and up and down escalators and so on, freight elevators and things, she'd been bumped up a little bit. So I was going to originally touch up the fiberglass where it needed it, but I got kind of carried away and reglassed the entire boat and deck, cabin, everything. So she's actually stronger now than she was for the Atlantic crossing.
Had you been thinking about this Pacific crossing even when you were crossing the Atlantic, or is it something that came to you after you got back? And if so, what prompted that, do you think?
Well, I've thought about just about every conceivable voyage, you know, over the past 20 years. I've, you know, this has been my avocation. And so I've thought about all the possibilities. And when I designed Yankee Girl, she was designed to cross the Atlantic primarily. That was my objective. But with the capability of going across any ocean. And going across the North Atlantic is like, I think the distance is about 3,300 nautical miles, and that's further than you'd ever have to go at any one stretch to go around the world. See, I could have stopped in the Azores on that crossing and so on, which would almost have cut it in half. So I had considered sailing across the Pacific, and I've started to do that crossing a couple of times before and not been able to do it for one reason or another. So of course, when I was on the trip, even in my log, I say things like, I'll never, you know, make another crossing again. This is it. This will last me for the rest of my life, and so on. But you get over that after a while, after you've been ashore for a while. And another reason that I've always wanted to make this trip is that I used to live in Australia when I was young, and I'd like to go back down there again.
Will that be your first landfall?
No, I'm making several stops. The distance across the Pacific is twice the distance across the Atlantic. Really big. I was just looking up the statistics the other day. It's 64 million square miles, the Pacific Ocean. It's just unbelievably large. And but again, the longest stretch is to Honolulu, which is about 2,200 nautical miles, or two-thirds of distance across the Atlantic. From Honolulu, the longest I'll go is, I'm going down to Samoa. I'll stop, hopefully, in the Line Islands on the way down. So that's only a little over 1,000 miles to that point. And then the distances are even shorter after that.
What are some of the things that you're doing to prepare for this trip that are different from the preparations that you had to make for crossing the North Atlantic?
Well, I think you might say that all of the big items were out of the way as a result of the Atlantic voyage. You know, the boat, the steering system, the provisioning, and so on. However, I've made the boat a little bit stronger with the fiberglass because the boat will have a little more abuse by going in and out of ports, anchoring, and this sort of thing is where you pick up most of the abuse. The communications will be vastly improved. Before I had 5 radios, this time I think I'll have 8 radios. It's kind of funny, and I just chuckle all the time because the like at the boat shows, people look at the boat and they say, well, you know, it's a home-built boat and it's just a little boat, and they don't think it has the capabilities that it does. But it's a very fast boat, very stable, very safe. It goes way beyond what anybody understands. And in terms of the technology, I'll have very sophisticated ham equipment. I'll be able to communicate with aircraft, ships. I may even go into the marine net, but I doubt that, the marine operator through the telephone system. But I don't think I'll do that. But I'll have satellite navigation on the boat so that I have automatic updates as these satellites pass over and so on. So she's really at the edge of the technology. Depth finders that go down to 1,000 feet, knot meters that tell me my speed within a tenth of a knot and things like this. So that really always makes me chuckle because people think of the boat as being very primitive, and yet it's very, very sophisticated.
So if you don't want to, you don't have to shoot the sun or take or whatever you call that to find out exactly where you are.
Well, assuming that it works properly. But when you're out in that, which is really a hostile environment and a very corrosive environment, electronics take a real beating. And the smaller the boat, the greater beating they take, not only physically, but they're more exposed and so on. So you can't rely on those things. That's why we have redundancy built in terms of, you know, like I have multiple radios and so on. And whereas I have satellite navigation, I also can find my position by talking to aircraft and ships. I can also find my position myself, of course. I'll have two sextants along. And I like to navigate. I enjoy that. It's kind of fun. And so I don't at all rely on these other systems. That would not be wise. Now, some people, when they're getting into something like this, they say, oh, well, gee, I'll get a satellite navigation system, and then I don't have to learn navigation. Well, that wouldn't be a very good approach at all.
Because they could end up with the equipment down, and then they would know where they were.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And it, you know, you can have antenna failures, and the antennas, they're making some great advances in the antennas for satellite navigation, but they still are still highly susceptible to any saltwater damage. So I'm actually going to have the antennas inside the boat to help protect them.
Will it make a difference being able to talk to so many different people this trip, as opposed to the last trip where you, if I recall correctly, were not able at some points to talk to anybody?
That'll be a vast improvement. It really will. Just tremendous. Because I suppose most people think, gee, it's fun. You know, you'll be able to talk to people and that'll be reassuring. I don't think of it as being reassuring to me so much as being able to get a message back to Sally and my parents. Because if I don't talk to anyone for a while, let's see, then I think, oh, gee, they're going to start worrying about me, and then I worry about them worrying about me. So it'll be helpful to me to know that they know where I am more than anything else. Plus, it'll be great, you know, it'll be great to talk to people, but they can't really do anything to help you or help you get away from the misery, but it definitely will be a help.
Over the last couple of years, certainly people in the upper Midwest who've heard about you see you as an adventurer, and people who've met you at boat shows and other kinds of things around the country also see you as an adventurer. And it seems to me that this time that we're living in is, for most people, not a very adventuresome time, or at least in most people's lives there isn't an opportunity, at least we don't see it, for a great deal of adventure. What are some of the elements about adventure that you see for yourself, and how you've consciously created or set yourself up to have adventures that people might learn something from?
Well, that's a very complex question, really. But in a way, the things I do are sort of adventurous. But I don't think of them as adventures. I think of them as projects. And when I set off, or not set off, but when I undertook this Atlantic project, that was the challenge I'd set for myself was to design a boat that could cross the Atlantic Ocean, the smallest practical size boat, not to sail across the Atlantic, not to go to Europe or anything like that, because I would have taken a plane if I was going to go to Europe. But it was I was interested in, and still am very, very interested in solving problems. That's what really fascinates me. And that's the creative part of the trip. When I think of adventure, and I know everybody has a different interpretation of that, but I like to do things in an efficient way. I don't want to come back with these tremendously exciting stories about how I ran out of food and I was eating toothpaste the last couple of weeks, you know, and I didn't have any water and I just drank, you know, the juice off my vegetables for the last week and this sort of thing. I want to come in looking good, you know, in good condition, and have plenty of food and water left over, and have made a very efficient, fast crossing. So I don't really think of it in terms of the adventure where you say, oh, I'm going to jump in a raft and go down the Amazon or something. It would be adventurous in some ways if you didn't know what you were doing. And then, you know, it can really get adventurous. But I think that planning, preparation, and the research that goes with that is the most interesting part. And that carries over in virtually anything you do. The people that are successful are the ones that do the research and planning and preparation. And if you enjoy that part of it, generally speaking, you'll be successful. Another big aspect of that is the psychological preparation. It's probably the most overlooked area of preparation there is in anything, not just in crossing oceans or mountain climbing, where it may be more obvious, you know, when you find out why you failed. It's probably the most common reason for failure in undertakings like of this nature. It's probably also a very common, I think, cause of failure in other areas, like people that go into business, say. They'll think about, well, I'm going to put in a little business like a bakery, and they think about location, they think about supplies, they think about the volume, and they think about the ovens and the equipment they'll need and so on. What they don't think about is that to run a bakery, you may have to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning and bake until 6 when your customers come in at 8 and so on, and the effect that's going to have on their lifestyle and their family and so on and so forth. It's maybe a 6 or 7 day a week job. And they haven't thought about the psychological aspect. So after a year or so, they may say, geez, I really don't like the bakery business. And they may be very successful, but yeah, I just don't like this. And they find out that the reason they're getting out of the business is because it's the psychological side.
What are you doing to psychologically prepare for this trip?
Well, I haven't done as much this time as I did last time, to be very honest. Last time I worked on it for about a year, because I had been defeated by that in a previous voyage, and severely defeated by a psychological problem, and to the point where it was almost fatal. You know, it was a very serious problem. So I knew that I had to be adequately prepared. The reason you need that is it's combined with discipline, too. You have to be very, very disciplined when you go out like that. And I knew that I would need that sort of a backlog of determination to carry me through the low points, which can be really severe at times. For this voyage, I know better the boat's capabilities and my capabilities, and I don't feel that it's going to be as difficult a crossing. I'm sure it won't be as difficult unless I have problems with, well, there are always problems you can have with hurricanes, whales, and things like that, or other unforeseen problems. But
you talk about backlog, something to draw on. How do you build such a thing up? By thinking about the trip, by going out and practicing a lot, by loading the boat and making sure you know where everything is. What kinds of things contribute to that backlog? As I understand, you're saying it's a sense that it's someplace you can dig into when things get a little bit rough to calm yourself and to remind yourself of what direction you're going in.
Well, there are actually several things that you can do. The most obvious thing is I just psych myself up. Now, it's difficult this trip, and I won't get into that because it gets kind of complicated, but last time I just kept psyching myself up and thinking, I wouldn't associate with anybody, and I still won't that has any negative thoughts. I just don't have time for those people. I just kept psyching myself up and puffing myself up until when I left Virginia, I felt like I could walk across the Atlantic. I was ready. Nothing was going to stop me, although I wasn't going to be foolish about it, but nothing within reason was going to stop me. And so first of all, it's psyching yourself up. Secondly, it's eliminating as much of the fear as you can, and that's done through planning again. Most fear is lack of understanding and lack of preparation. So I studied and I prepared and I over-prepared and I had, backup upon backup. And I tested procedures and I tried to eliminate everything I possibly could. And then I avoided a lot of distractions. I didn't talk to anybody before I left the press or anything like that, so I could concentrate on the voyage. Another thing I do is I have all sorts of little tricks that I use to help me get by. The most effective one, I think, was, it's a common problem. This gets rather complicated, but when you're tired and when you're frightened, especially when you're very, very tired, now I'm talking about where you haven't slept for 24 hours or so, you can start to begin to hallucinate. And hallucination can be very dangerous, and that's part of the problem I had on that previous voyage. And I've had hallucinations, several times. So that's where the discipline comes in to help you avoid that. Now, when you hallucinate, generally, it's like a dream, except you're awake. And you're, like your dreams, your mind is filling in what you need. It's saying, if you need another person to talk to, it'll create another person to talk to. Unfortunately, a lot of times these people are hostile, and they can be very hostile. So to circumvent that problem, I decided to take along somebody, some imaginary friend that would be friendly and supportive.
Someone consciously now, before you left, you had decided that you were taking along a friend.
That's right. As a matter of fact, it's in my note. It says, take along imaginary friend, ? Because I wasn't too sure at that time. But I anticipated this, and I thought, well, this is one way to get around this. Well, this friend, and, everybody talks to themselves all the time. I don't know. It always amazes me when people say, well, I don't talk to myself. Well, it's the only way you can communicate with yourself, so you have to do that. And this friend that I had along was sort of like an extension of myself, sort of a conscience and so on. And it's very helpful in motivating me and in helping me to make decisions, which become very difficult the more tired you become. So I would have long conversations with this fellow. We'd go back and forth, and he'd keep sometimes really get on my case and berate me about things and this sort of thing.
But this is someone you've designed for yourself.
Well, he just sort of evolved, really. I don't have any name for him or anything like that. And I fully expected, and when I got to England, just disappeared, and I expect when I leave again that we'll reestablish that relationship, and I expect to be very helpful. And also for joking around. Now, I think of it like in a restaurant. You won't see a fellow in a restaurant just sit there and burst out laughing. People just don't do that. And telling a joke to yourself isn't much fun, you know. But as you get into this sort of relationship, you sort of start to make up little jokes. And you think of this other person, you say, well, wait till he hears this one, this will kill him, or see what he thinks about this. And I know it sounds sort of strange now, but it's very helpful to maintain your equilibrium.
Kids do that, it seems to me, and this may not be the same thing at all, but it seems like kids have imaginary friends at some point. I did, I know, and I don't remember that imaginary friend, but my parents tell me that I carried on lengthy conversations with this person when I was 4 or 5 years old, and I didn't have any siblings at that time, and I suppose that that person filled in the boredom. Do you think it's something like that?
Yes, as I do. I think that's a very good analogy, and I think it's something that it's one of these things we sort of grow away from. You say, well, geez, you don't walk around saying I have an imaginary friend. One of the things that kids can do. And I was the same way, I guess. I didn't have a long-term imaginary friend when I was young. But, whenever you're playing games and so on, you always have some other guy. And you watch him coming around that way, I'll get him this way, and this sort of thing. And as you can see, kids can go on for hours and hours like that. And it's good for them, you know. They're developing certain skills. So I think that's a very good observation.
So this person may likely join you again, and you'll talk to that person, and when things get a bit tough, that person may end up giving you some advice or at least pulling you back into line.
Yes, and, well, one of the things that happens when you're out at sea like that, or in other circumstances too, but especially as far as I'm concerned, or from my experience, when you're out there, you tend to sort of get into, if you're steering the boat, and I don't steer the boat any more than I have to. I steer it very, very little. She normally takes care of herself. But at the beginning of the trip, I'll usually steer because I feel better when I'm steering. You tend to get cold and you're tired. You don't drink water and you don't get rest. And you can get into a real bad state, a real serious state.
Physically run down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You just don't drink water, and you can go into sort of a trance after a while. And so what I do is I keep asking myself, are you cold, wet, tired, or hungry, or thirsty? But I keep repeating that to myself over and over and over. And if I am, I do something about it. I say, well, are you cold? And I say, well, yeah, I am. Well, then why don't you do something about it? Because otherwise you'll sit there until you get so cold you can hardly move. Or you won't drink, and you're still steering the boat. You fixate so strongly on your destination and moving and getting there. You've got thousands of miles of water to cover, and you get into this terrible trance. And you do that in the car, too. You know, you'll be driving along, so you'd say, let's stop and have a Dairy Queen or something like that. And you say, no, well, we just got a few more miles. It's the same thing, except a much more extreme example of this goal fixation.
That same kind of thing happened to Charles Lindbergh when he flew across the Atlantic. He had hallucinations, had as he described them, ghosts come up around him in the cockpit, and he managed to make it, of course, but he described going through that just before sunrise, I think, mm-hmm. on his trip.
Yeah, well, I don't remember the specifics. I've read, you know, his account, but you see how, that is an example where you get these other people, these ghosts or whatever, and again, when you're desperate, say in his case, to rest, they'll say, hey, there's an aircraft carrier down there. Well, not in, perhaps in his time, but they say, hey, there's an aircraft carrier. And you'll see that aircraft carrier just as clear as you could possibly see. You'll see the numbers, you'll see people on it, everything. Say, well, why don't we land? We'll just land a few minutes, no one will find out about it. Stretch our legs, and we'll take off again. They won't tell anybody. And they'll just fly right down into the water. And there was I heard yesterday that this fellow rowing across the Pacific fell asleep and went right up on the rocks, is what I've heard. Now, I really shouldn't say that because I'm not positive of it. But this sort of thing is not uncommon, where people are hallucinating. And I know one time I sailed right up almost on Miami Beach. I was inside the breaker line. And I could see a gas station there. It was a Union 76. And I can still see it just as clear as a bell. And everybody knows there are no gas stations on the beach in Miami. But I could see it, and I was going to stop there and make a phone call. And the only thing that brought me around was the breakers themselves.
I'm interested in talking to you more about how people have approached you since you made your Atlantic crossing and the whole business of adventure. Do you feel comfortable in the position that people want to put you in? I read a little blurb from the energy conference that you went to the other day that described you or compared you with Charles Lindbergh. Do you feel comfortable with that sort of thing?
Well, I'll tell you, it's a funny thing. It's easy to talk about other people and you know, their reactions and so on, but when it's something that happens to you, it's sometimes very hard to understand. And I don't grasp that at all, to be quite honest. I don't see that. It was just something I was doing for my own satisfaction. And, of course, I have done this purposely to a certain extent, too. But I don't really see anything that unusual, to be honest. And I don't see any reason to be treated any differently. But I have always, I go by lots of little old-fashioned philosophies and things in my life, which seem sort of antiquated to a lot of people, but they work for me. And I like to approach things as a as challenges. And I guess I'm sort of stubborn in a way. And if something is supposed to be done one way, sometimes I'll do it just the opposite, just for the experience of doing it differently, because I think that's how you learn a lot of things. So when I landed in England and there was a lot of attention and so on, I thought about that a little bit, and I thought, well, a lot of people, I suppose the obvious thing to do would be to say, when everyone's saying congratulations and you're so brave and you've done this and so on, say, hey, I guess that's true. Maybe I really am pretty good. So I said, well, that's the obvious thing, so I'm going to do just the opposite. And I said, I'm not going to change one bit. And I made up my mind not to change, and I've stuck with it. I just refused to change. And the very nice thing about this is that people come to me all the time and they say, gee, you're just kind of an average guy, just a regular person. We call you up and you answer the phone, and I call you up and I talk to your mother, she answers the phone or so on. And I find that very, very refreshing and rewarding when people come up and say, gee, you're just an average guy. And they kid me all the time. They're kidding me a couple of days ago about this, that they say I look like an accountant, or I don't look like this adventure that they have imagined. And sometimes, like at boat shows, if I'm standing by the boat somewhere, if just about anybody's standing next to me, they'll come and talk to the other person and say, well, congratulations, because I'm the least likely person, I guess, that they would imagine. So I want to just stay the way I am. I don't want to change a bit.
Would you miss it, though, do you think, if it all stopped tomorrow?
No, I wouldn't miss it a bit. It wouldn't faze me in the slightest. As a matter of fact, in a way, I would almost welcome it, because it'd give me more time to spend on doing the things that I want to do.
I wanted to ask you about that, too. You talked earlier about mental preparation and planning and how important that is in an effort like the one you're planning. Do you have a mechanism? Do you have some tips or hints, things that you use that help you to continue to focus? For most people in their daily lives, there are countless distractions, and there are days when people come home and wonder what it was they set out to do in the morning, and they're darn sure they didn't do that. How do you stay focused on what it is you want to do?
That's another good question. It seems to me that it's just automatic. This is just an all-consuming thing with me, and I always think... They asked Newton once about discovering the laws of gravity. I said, how the heck did you figure that out? He said, I just thought about it all the time. And that's the way I feel. I just think about it all the time. It's probably sort of monotonous for Sally, especially, because she's exposed to this 24-hour-a-day process. Friday, I got up at 3 o'clock in the morning and I worked till 9. And I went back to bed until noon. I got up and worked again. So right now I'm a little concerned about the time factor, because I've got an awful lot to do. But other than that, I enjoy that. I enjoy being very heavily immersed in whatever I'm doing. That's another one of my basic principles, is I like to immerse myself and really work on the problems and try to do it as efficiently as I can. I'm still working on problems. I'll be working on some again today that I've been working on for 3 years, and I'm still plugging away on those. I think I've found the solution. I just feel great. I think I figured out on the way back from Miami a better way to carry my gasoline in the boat, a safer way. So I don't really I don't ever feel that I have to focus on it. It just sort of comes automatically.
I don't know exactly if I have a question to follow up to that, but you mentioned gasoline and where you might put it in the boat, and that seems like a very specific kind of problem, one that one can get one's hands on. I'm wondering about the things that aren't physical that you can't get your hands on, and I know we talked about psychological preparation, but I'm thinking about the distractions that must come all the time, the phone calls, the requests to speak, and so forth. Do those kinds of things drain you, distract you, or are you able to dispatch them quickly and get on with things?
Well, the lecturing I really enjoy. That is really fun for me, and I meet a lot of nice people, and it's just a real fun experience for me. So I enjoy that very much. And people ask me, they say, how the heck can you answer questions about this all the time? Over and over, you know, interviews and so on. And I don't mind that at all either, as long as they're intelligent questions. I talk about it forever because it's my favorite subject. If people don't ask intelligent questions, then it's just the opposite. I don't want to spend any time talking to them at all. But most of the people, you know, 99% of people ask good, intelligent questions, and it's really interesting to discuss these things. As far as the time, I'm getting to the point now where time is becoming very, very critical. Every day is accounted for, and you always have things that come up that interfere with, like equipment. Some of the equipment is still not in my hands, and a lot of things are coming in the next couple of weeks. But I have a very rigid schedule. Now, it's funny in a way, because I'm saying I'm leaving June 1st, and I intend to leave June 1st. Now, I don't have to leave June. I could leave July 1st, too. It wouldn't really make that much difference in a way, although it's more of a hurricane threat. And so that's why I'm leaving on that specific day. But this is something I've set up for myself, and I plan to meet that date, unless something really unforeseen happens.
So you will likely be taking fewer phone calls and perhaps doing fewer interviews in the coming weeks.
Yes, and I don't like to do that because if people want to interview me and want to take the time, I've never refused an interview or refused to cooperate with anyone. And it's very nice. I was just saying this to Sally again a couple of days ago, that in all of the people we've talked to and all the newspaper accounts and everything, never had any bad experiences at all, which is really nice because you hear so much about that, you know, the press doing this and so on and some of these scandal magazines. But that seems to be a different group of people, apparently, reporters and so on. But I've had just very nice relations and have some nice friends, you know, that have developed as a result of these interviews and so on.
Your book, the one about the crossing of the North Atlantic, is that going to be out soon?
I don't know. There are some people looking at it now, some other publishers and so on, and it may come out in the next couple months or two. I'm not too sure about that. So I really can't say too much about that.
Have you learned to fly since you've been back?
Well, I had taken lessons years ago, and that was back in college days, and I didn't have the money to finish my lessons. So then last summer when I said I was going to spend some time doing what I want to do, I went out and I took some lessons. And I paid for lessons that I haven't even had time to take yet. And I put it on my calendar for last December to finish up. I couldn't do it then. And I said a couple weeks ago, I'm definitely going to do this before I leave. Now it never even entered my mind again because it's just out of the question, which really disappoints me. I flew a few hours when I was out in Virginia with a friend. But I just don't have time, and I shouldn't say resent that, but I don't know what word I'm trying to think of right now, but I regret it, I guess I should say. Yeah, I don't resent it, but I regret it.
Is there anything that you can think of that you'd like to add?
Well, I always like to get in a little pitch for people doing what they want to do in life. I think people would be a lot happier if they would take a little time, like I did last summer where I said, well, I'm going to think about what I want to do with my life. I think that this is an enormously beneficial area. If people would just say, I want to do something, and they do it. I don't have to do the whole thing. You just do part of it. Like say a fellow says, I always wanted to be a radio interviewer. I'd sure like to do that. You know, I want to do that, but here I am working as an accountant, but I always want to interview people. That doesn't mean he has to quit his job as an accountant and go to radio broadcasting school or something like that. But just call up, call KSJN and say, say, I've always wanted to see what these interviews are like. Would you mind if I just went along? I won't say anything. I'd just like to see what it's about. And he might find out that he made the right decision at being an accountant. Maybe he'd go down with a guy and say, oh boy, this is going to be fun. We're going to go interview Johnny Cash. He's going to be in town or something. The guy says, oh, that's what I always want to do. So they go down there and they say, well, Mr. Cash doesn't have time after all today, so we're sorry. You just can't skip it. The guy said, gee, this business isn't quite as exciting as I thought it was going to be. But the only way to find out is actually try it. Go do a little bit of it. And I just wish people would do that. And I not only do the things that they want to do in terms of vocation and so on, or what their dream is, but be self-determining in your whole life and other things you do too, like your relationships with others, your interest in politics, your philosophy and so on. Don't just do what the crowd does. And of course, this everyone's heard this, but I'm talking about actually trying it sometime, actually doing it. Let's take religion as a good example. There are lots of religions around, and they have all of their things written out for you. But sit down and think about it yourself. Say, well, what do I think about God? You know, not what is it and what have other people told me, but what do I think about God, and what do I think God wants me to do, and what should I be doing in life? And if you go away and spend a few days all alone, away from radio, television, and all that sort of thing, other people, in just a few days you can find out an awful lot about yourself and where you really fit in. It'll be a very valuable experience.